This is the Fantastic Books Podcast,
the fantasy and sci-fi book review podcast for fantasy fanatics, book nerds, and lovers of lore and stories.
Covering some of the most loved fantasy series as well as brand new novels.
With your hosts, Anna
and Sam. Let's see what we're reading this week. Welcome back, fantastic listeners. This is Sam.
And Anna.
And this week, we continue our coverage of The Sapien Empire by Nathan Ogloff, chapters 16 through 18.
Yeah, it's a little bit of a shorter episode this week, but there's a lot to talk about, as per usual. We ended off last week with the end of part one, and I think we made some pretty big predictions and guesses about what is going to happen in the rest of the book, and I'm already wrong, as I'm seeing in these chapters, so you're keeping us on our toes for sure.
Absolutely. It's crazy. We're entering a whole new civilization with our characters in this world right now.
We get a lot of new characters in this section too.
Yes. The world continues to open up as this story progresses, which I find very interesting, where obviously you need that exponential expansion. But man, the world becomes so much more diverse even with this next section of chapters.
I guess a quick question about the whole series, because we're on, is it book one of, is it going to be a trilogy or is there eight books?
Eight books.
Are they all going to focus on Shindo and his life, or is this going to get bigger and bigger as it goes on?
You're actually correct in both regards. So Shindo is the main character. The crux of the story does focus around him, but also the world does get bigger and bigger because I've told multiple people this, that he's rebuilding civilization across the planet. So the whole planet is involved.
Whoa. Okay. Yeah, that makes sense why it's going to be so many books. That's a lot of work for him to do.
Yes.
Now, yeah.
I don't have to do it. I get to do it. Get to do this.
That's, yeah. And you've got them all planned out already, right? All eight books?
So books five through eight, there's a rough idea of where I want to go. There's one that has a temporary title, and I'm kind of trying to figure out what I want to call it. There's three of them that I have titles that I really like. And then books three and four, I'm planning them out right now. But again, it's not as rough as five through eight. I have a better idea of what I want to do, but I still have like areas here and there that I got to really iron out. And so slowly but surely.
That's fascinating. I give you so much credit that it's such an expansive anthology and that there's so much source material to draw from. And I'm excited to see how Shindo progresses, grows, changes. I mean, even with the book one, he's had such a rapid change in development. So it's really cool.
I'm excited to see the other parts of the world too, because right here at the beginning of chapter 16, we're already seeing like a different community outside of the domain. And so I'm interested to see how other parts of the world have adapted to the All Silence and the loss of civilization, because we had the one domain society, which was structured around like sort of like city states. And then we have these off-grid communities we're seeing in chapter 16, which are more like communes, I suppose. Mm. So I'm interested in the different types of civilizations and societies that have been developed and how they're going to get enveloped as Shindo progresses and rebuilds civilization as he goes. Do you want to get into chapter 16?
Yeah, let's hop right on in. So as you were setting the scene for us, we do get the shift in perspective at this off-grid community in the interior. We're introduced to Kellen, which is the leader of the off-grid, and they're struggling to keep things in order. There's definitely not as many resources and people as you would see in the domain or the new civilization. He reminisces that the waters of the lake used to be far off, but now they're causing flooding.
Yeah, so we're seeing tough times with the environment as well.
Yeah, climate changes. Houses in the off-grid are running on wind turbines. And we saw a little bit of that within the domain of people having supplemental power sources to aid their everyday lives. But when you're solely
self-reliant?
Yeah, when you are like, this is your only form of power and, you know, it can be faulty. It puts you in a very vulnerable position. Kellen's son, Zach, is also within this section of chapters. He's trying to repair one of the wind turbines, but they're running out of usable wire. And they decide that some people may have to move in and together, you know, to survive the winter due to lack of supplies and housing. So we can see just how intense the situation is getting for these people. They're getting by, but they're certainly not thriving.
And as we see in this chapter and later in one of the other chapters too, they're sort of, it seems like isolated little communities with the Rust Razors dominating the territory in between them. So are these more like individual family groups than the domain would be?
They're definitely smaller communities. So as mentioned in the near the end of part one, you go back to Shindo's compound, which is just a smaller sort of village of like a couple hundred people. And these off-grids are similar. They're not more than 1,000 people. They're quite small. So yeah, if you think of like just a village in the interior of the continent, you're right on the mark.
Perfect. Yeah. So they're definitely a lot smaller. This one that we're seeing is really struggling to have enough food. And when Kellen, after this conversation with Zach, where they're repairing the wind turbines, he goes back to his house and he's got conflict with his other family members. So his wife, is it Celia? She's worried about rationing. And I guess the Rust Razors come looking for food and kind of pick on these people. So they don't have enough food. And then his nephew, Mattis, is concerned about a defense wall that needs repair and that roofs in the village are leaking. So it seems like everything's kind of on the verge of breaking at any moment here. Yeah. Like they don't have enough water to put out all these fires. And then on top of it, the population of this off-grid is small enough where there might not even be enough people to do the work to fix all of these things if they can even find the supplies to do it. So Kellen's having a really tough time. He's an interesting leader because he seems very set in his ways, and his other family members seem more interested in trying new solutions or having a little bit more of, I guess, like an empathetic leadership style. For example, when he talks about having to move people in together, I think it's his wife who says, like, frictions are going to start to run high if you put all these people into one spot and make them all live together in one house over the winter. So he's an interesting foil to Shindo's leadership style, which is very empathetic. And then Jerem, who's very, I think, big picture and more, I guess, like interested in like progress at large. So now we're getting different types of leadership styles, which I thought was really awesome for you to incorporate that so that it's not just one kind of leader. And then, you know, as they all start to come together, I'm sure they're going to have different approaches to things.
Yeah. At one point, Zach suggests that they leave the off-grid and head towards the coast. There were rumors from some of the Rust Razors how Vibran is no longer Arch Lord Chief and that there's a woman in charge who's making things better. Mattis and Zach think that the coast sounds better, but Kellen thinks that they should stay there. So again, that stubbornness is predominant with his mindset there. And Kellen does say people can leave, but he won't risk making his family leave.
Which, and so, in the time jump later, we see that they do end up all leaving, but I like that it took them a while to get to that point.
Yeah. Well, it's also tough because nothing, especially in this type of world, is guaranteed, where you may hear rumor of life being better, but you uproot your family, your safety, your security to take the risk to travel, hopefully get there one piece, and then hope that it's a safe place to travel to, because theoretically, the rumor could be wrong. They could go to the new domain and it'd be even worse than where they are now. So I see both sides of it. It could be extraordinarily daunting to live in this world and try and take chances like that.
Yeah, I feel like you have a really good approach of seeing how people would realistically react in situations. And I'm sure that that comes from a lot of different sources, but like here you've got these two different opposing ideas of some people saying the coast sounds better, and then what Sam just said, it's more realistic that people would stay put. So I like that you're pulling in sort of really natural human reactions, even though this is sort of a quote-unquote like sci-fi story or dystopian story. Because I think a lot of the times in books we see people make really grand decisions, especially in fantasy, and it's, you know, like the farm boy who has his child of destiny moment to go off and like become the hero. Like,
yeah,
it, they always say yes to that, but people don't always say yes in the real life. So I think you have a lot more of like a grounded approach to your character's decision-making processes.
And then we get the big time jump. A decade passes. We finally get back to Shindo's perspective. Before we jump into this section, I just wanted to ask, it's assumed, but I would love confirmation. People have a relatively normal lifespan to humans like in present day.
Yeah. Actually, what's interesting is that you assume, or most people assume, that if civilization collapsed, we'd automatically have lifespans that go back to what you see in the 19th century. And people say they lived to 47, and that's misleading, just because if you look at how averages and statistics work, the reason the average lifespan was 47 was because there was a high infant mortality rate. So when you got like 3, 5, 5, 5, and then 70, when you average that out, it's like, I mean, this is just a rough idea. It's 45. You can go back even further. And in the Middle Ages, if you live to be 21, you were expected to live another 50 years. So, yeah, I mean, the lifespans are, very similar to what we have now, only in that, like, our lifespan is similar to what we've always had, but just now we have, like, a lower, much lower infant mortality rate.
I'm glad you brought that up, because I feel like people always talk about how people in the past had way shorter lives, and I'm like, well, not really. The numbers can be really misleading if you're not accounting for how many people die under the age of 10. That makes a lot of sense then. So is Shindo at this point
40s, mid-40s?
No, he's got to be younger, because I didn't...
No, he's in his mid-30s, because at the beginning of the novel, he's in his mid-20s. And also, I just need to clarify that it's not that the second scene is 10 years after the first one. Those are both concurrent. I just don't like mention the specific date until we get back to the domain, because it's the domain that uses those dates specifically. And these off-gridders, they have, for the most part, a cyclical view of time, because keeping track of it doesn't really has no point at this point.
That makes sense.
Okay, cool.
Yeah, I was going to say, there's no way they could have waited 10 years at this point to then go and move towards the domain.
Perfect. Okay, yeah, that was a great clarifying point, just because I was like, wow, they really sunk their heels in, like, we'll get there when we feel ready, you know?
No, I think that makes sense. Yeah, because I think Shindo at one point mentions that he was taken by Vibrun when he was in his teens.
Yeah.
You know, he got taken away from his parents pretty young, which is sad.
Yeah.
But speaking of Shindo, so much has changed for him in these past 10 years. So he's sitting in his shop garage taking stock of all that's new and different. So he has a secretary now.
Yep, Zenny.
Yep. He no longer sleeps in the shop garage, which is should have happened even under Vibrun, but he didn't get his own space. And one huge thing, which obviously is something that would be really important to him as the leader or the underlord chief, is that he gets to create machines for the people now. So he's not creating weapons and horrible things. He's actually getting to build the stuff that he wants to build, and it's going towards improving life in the domain.
Yes, and we are presented with a really nice scene. Shindo meets with Tate, the boy he had helped earlier with the prosthetic arm, and their interaction just really wholesome. By being a trial, Tate was able to get this prosthetics movement forward and able to help so many more people, and how Shindo was calm and reassuring the whole time, and it made him a lot less scared. And there's like a really cool moment where Shindo kind of gets to live to be the hero, where he says, like, you truly are a blessing from the abstract. Shindo has a wonderful response. He says, everyone in the domain has something from their past they wish they could change, including me. Let us all be glad that is not possible. Those experiences force us to do things we would not ordinarily do, making us who we are for the better. Would you be helping others had this not happened? I just really appreciate how full circle this moment is for him, where although he had suffered and really just been through so much, to kind of be clean on the other side and see how that experience allowed him to move forward and grow to help others was really cool. And my question for you, Nate, is was this scene always in your drafts as like an opportunity to show Shindo's growth, or through subsequent edits, you know, you had a eureka moment? Like, how did this come forward for you?
Yeah, this was not originally in the first draft, but once I had this scene with like Tate getting a prosthetic arm, I said it would make a lot more sense if like you kind of just see him as a young adult getting an upgrade to the prosthetic arm, and it really just it's meant to hammer in the long-term effects of these decisions that Shindo makes. So makes it when he's younger, and here's how it's like still helping this person. I don't think this scene was here until the third draft. So yeah, it definitely wasn't something that, I mean, this whole book has just mostly just part one undergone so many changes and revisions as I've just kind of like not been satisfied things and wanted to make myself better as an author. So yes, this is definitely a more recent addition to my revisions.
I thought it was a really important scene because I think when you're, you know, creating a book or outlining a story, it can be easy to focus on scenes that are plot-based and like moving a plot forward. But this scene really moves our characters forward, and we see how much Shindo has changed and how he interacts with people. And he even notes he's been kind of learning how to interact better with help from Jerem. But I think a lot of it is also the stress of not living under Vibran's horrible empire. And Shindo gets to do more good in the world, which is making him a better person. And then, like you said, we're seeing sort of those ripple effects of everything that's happening because he can do all of this. So I liked the circle back. I like that we get to see that he's been able to improve products for people. You know, he says Tate was helpful because he was sort of like the guinea pig of this prosthetics trial. So I just thought it was like a really nice scene, and I liked the dialogue in it a lot. And I thought it was actually really important to have this sort of like pause after we get a time jump, and it's not just like, here's all the crazy things that are new and all the stuff that's going on in the politics. We get kind of like this little breath of like human growth, and then we get to see the growth of the domain after that. So timing wise, I loved it.
Yeah, it was a very well laid scene.
Like I said, we do get to actually see a lot of the changes that have been made in the domain after this. And I think they're doing really good stuff here. I'm really impressed with a lot of the ideas you've come up with, specifically this scene where Jerem is talking about how there's separate training grounds for male versus female military recruits. And she did this specifically because there were too many lieutenants in her military who had served under Vibran and who would want to return to his horrible ways. But she wanted to protect female soldiers and still prepare them and like incorporate them into her new world. She had to do it by setting up this separate training ground, and even Tersona helped her do this. So the training grounds are in Cade. And so far every year there have been over 100 recruits yearly graduating from this military training camp. So it seems pretty good. It seems like the people are warming up a lot to Jerem's policies and programs and, you know, wanting to be a part of them. So I think that's awesome. I liked the whole idea here. And then Jerem gets to give like a graduation speech almost, which again is like just sort of showcasing the triumphs that are happening in the domain.
Yeah, and it's really beneficial for society to empower everyone to be able to defend and protect their home. So I think not only bolsters the military ranks, but allows the people of that population to feel like they're contributing, and it's just strategically and morally a great decision.
Yeah, and she sums it up really well. So Jerem does this speech. She's giving this group of graduates to her Lieutenant Marcy. And in the speech, she says that all of the women obviously have overcome a lot. And then she goes on to say, "I can't say the female branch will always work separately from the rest of the military. Therefore, I can't say you will never encounter these men. Know this, they will push you. They will try to remind you when you were not allowed to serve alongside them. Your job is to push back." And I loved it. I thought it was a great, like, girl power speech. It was one of my favorite moments in the book so far. I just thought it was, like, really exciting to see the women doing so well. And then also this acknowledgement that the men will push them, especially because they're coming from this background of working for Vibran, and he was such a pig. How did you feel writing this scene? Because I felt like it was like a really exciting scene to read.
How I wrote the scene was, this is actually a revision from the third draft that I read in front of my critique group. And they're like, you're kind of dealing with a complicated issue. There's some issues here. And so I was just like, all right, I'm going to just scrap that scene and put this in. My only concern was I didn't want to be too on the nose, and I guess you can say woke with it. Like, I just wanted to have, you know, like these messages of female empowerment and women can do a lot of what men can do, because I don't want my books to be complete sausage fests. So you definitely, they have a significant place in the military and politics. And I guess you can say like countering male primal evolutionary aggression that tend to sort of lean towards. Yeah, that was all going into it, but I also wanted to stress that like it's just a start. It's not like suddenly everything's just been flipped over and everything's better now. It's a significant step towards something better. And also, if you like this scene, Anna, whoa, just you wait until some later parts of the novel, because if you think this is empowering, there's going to be something we're going to be like, yes,
yay!
Maybe, I don't know. But I won't spoil it. I'll just wait for you guys to read it.
I'm excited now. No, I thought it was really well done. I thought it was uplifting. I thought it was realistic, like you said, to say it's not like Jerem just became leader and then everything is exactly the opposite of Vibran.
Right.
And
it sounds like, oh, we erased the guys being jerks. Like, no.
Like, right. Like, she's changing a society that was pretty rotten at its core when all of those people were in power. But the general population seems good, and it seems like they're responding really well to this change. So, yeah, it's just, you know, it's slow. People take a long time to change things and change their attitudes and opinions and power structures and everything. So they made a lot of progress in 10 years.
Right. And with all that progress, a good and interesting conversation takes place between Tersona and Jerem.
Yeah, a little warning here.
Yes. And I think it's important to exactly keep vigilant, stay sharp, where she says that she sees all the progress, but doesn't want her to get too confident because that's when she'll let her guard down. Jerem says that she thinks the abstract will keep her on her toes enough to keep her sharp so she won't get too soft. And this is a great callback to the book they found in the archive, talking about how different leadership structures got too complacent and that led to their downfall. So I'm enjoying, again, this theme of trying to make sure history doesn't repeat itself and our characters being self-aware enough to try and preserve themselves.
Yeah, I think it's working well. That book that they found in the archive, it's not a real book. Based on a real book, is it?
Oh, none of those books are based on real books. They're just meant to be sort of general commentaries I have on the world. And then I just say, this book focuses specifically on this. I'll just give it this name of blah, 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 blah.
Gotcha. Yeah, I assumed so, but I wanted to make sure we weren't missing references to anything that might be
real. Oh, yeah, like an Easter egg or something.
Yeah. Like, oh, they found the Art of War or something, you know?
I do actually make a brief reference to that. I can't remember exactly. It might be in this one or the next one, but it's briefly there.
Oh, nice.
Cool.
I can't believe I picked the one that off the back of my hand, just picked the one that happened to be in it. Yeah, so Jerem, I think, is still pretty effective as a leader. Tersona obviously just has more experience, and I think she's a little more guarded than Jerem because she did have to do so much work under Vibran. And then she reveals that this story, Tersona reveals this story where in order to become Lord Chief of Cade, when her husband was killed, she then had to defeat her own brother because he challenged her. And so I think she has just had a lot more turmoil in terms of backstabbing in her life than Jerem has had. So I think that's why she gives her this warning.
Mm.
Specifically because Tersona says he tried pulling some backhanded attack like Vic had done, which is why she killed Vic in the fight for Jerem becoming Lord Chief. And Tersona didn't want history to repeat itself and wanted to make sure Jerem didn't get caught off guard. So I, again, like this idea of them trying to actively fight against history repeating itself and getting too complacent or falling into the same patterns as the previous leaders. So I like that this is sort of an undercurrent now in part two, where they're working on rebuilding, but they don't want to have the same issues as the previous society.
Oh, for sure. And Tersona has some very intense parting words. She says, "I can make the hard decisions, but I don't think you realize the depths of what you've gotten yourself into."
A little foreboding.
Very foreboding. I really enjoyed this dynamic because although they are supportive, it's important to have people close to you that will challenge you and
not just be yes men.
Exactly. You need those people in your life, in your leadership, to like contradict you a little bit. That way you can really self-evaluate and hopefully come to even better decisions than if you were just self-governing. So I appreciate their dynamic.
I have a question now that we're getting into a bigger world. It's not related to this exact scene, but we're seeing like new characters like Marcy popped up in this section. And we had the previous characters like Kellen and Zach and everyone. How do you keep track of all of your characters? Like, are you... Because we've talked to a good handful of authors now, and some people are really on top of spreadsheets and lists, and some people have, like, everything's just in their brain. You know, what's sort of your approach?
It's mostly... I do have, like, a list of, in, like, just the Scrivener document I use of, like, this character and this is who they are. For the most part, it's just in my head, and it also depends on how significant the character is. If it's a character that's in a one scene, usually I just give a name, I give a brief description. Sometimes if someone's like, "Can I be in your novel, Nathan?" I'll just be like, "Sure, you can be this side character." And so it's like, what does this character look like? Oh, he wanted to be in the novel. I'll just make him look like that. And so personality does he have? Who would that be in this post-apocalyptic world? People like that, I give a name, which is usually just a name you'd think of in real life, but I sort of modify it to make it morph a bit, which actually sort of matches how names sometimes change throughout history.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, so it's just a combination of being on written down, and some of it's just, it's in my head just because I know what I, the direction of what I want to do with it.
Cool. Yeah, right in the middle.
Yeah, because I know at least you're working on your own story, Anna. You have had a lot of different spreadsheets and resources.
Oh, I love to-do lists and spreadsheets. Yeah. And have like 8 different notebooks with everything all written down. And yeah, I'm that kind of planner. But then we have some authors who are like, "Oh, I don't outline anything. I don't keep track of my characters. I just pants my way the whole way through my book." And
fascinating.
There's different approaches for everyone, but I'm impressed that there's so many different ways people come to writing and can keep track of everything.
Oh, for sure. Now, this brings us to chapter 17. Here we have a scene where Jerem and Shindo are in a tactical planning room, and they're looking over a map of the Canyon and Hood bases.
Is Hood a new, not city-state?
No, the city states were Sear, Cade, Columbia, and Island, but it's called Canyon just because, and this is a little piece of local geography that I know, so, which is why I chose my area. It basically, that base is situated at the Fraser Canyon, where the Fraser River goes through before it becomes a delta near the ocean. So that's why I called it Canyon. So, it's a simple name, and I just thought it'd be kind of interesting if I had this base that sort of straddled both sides with a bridge in between.
Gotcha. I like that you're pulling from your own area. I actually just saw this thing because so many people set their fantasy books in England or London that there's now people who live in London who are like specific editors who will check like your local geography and your local understanding if you set your book in London, because a lot of people don't know anything about it, but they'll still stick their story there. So they'll specifically edit for like accuracy of that.
That's fascinating.
The city. Yeah, I thought that was kind of fun. Is there a Mount Hood over there? Is that what Hood is based on?
I can tell you right now that they're both located near the deltas of the Columbia River and the Fraser River. So Canyon is the Fraser, and then Hood is where the Columbia starts going into the interior. And I might have just looked at a map and just found something that kind of looked like Hood. And so I said, I'll just call this Hood base.
Yeah, I like how you're kind of taking names that exist for the places now and saying, like, what would happen if we lost all societal information and the names changed over time and this is how you're coming to it. It's really, really smart. But they're looking over these maps because Jerem is saying how people are coming down the river towards Canyon, and they actually shot at them because they thought they were Rustrazers. But these people that are coming towards the domain are the off-gridders, i.e. the people we saw in the beginning of Chapter 16 and others like them. And they're driving these vehicles called All-Terrains, and they have made two big camps right outside the domain. So they are gathering in a pretty large force, trying to get into the domain because of all the rumors that have been coming around. And presumably Kellen's group was not alone in their struggles. There's a lot of people coming from off-grids who I'm sure have very similar stories.
Yeah.
And Shindo is taking the very empathetic approach and Jerem is taking the very logical approach. And we see these two ideas collide in this whole beginning part of the chapter. Because Shindo wants to let them in. He's asking why they're there. If they want to be a part of the domain. But Jerem is saying that they can't afford a population spike because of taxes. And specifically says, you know, we redirected taxes to go to your salvage program, Shindo. And we also are improving infrastructure with our taxes. And then they have this thing called the Lord Chief Payout, which is a cash reward to whichever Lord Chief improves their community the most. So they can't just have all these people show up without the resources to care for them or the space in the society to, like, fit them in.
I thought this was very well thought out. I think many times we get that concept of the altruistic approach, which, you know, truth be told, I would be very similar to Shindo. Like, oh, we got to help everyone. But the actual in practice approach with this of saying, like, well, where are we going to put these people? How are you going to feed them, clothe them, house them? Trying to navigate that as a leader, I really appreciated, although it's harsh, Jerem's perspective on it. They're trying to find a compromise to this. And
I liked the specific line where she said she's also concerned about off-gridders integrating into society and she doesn't want there to be conflict between the people. Because even if you have, you know, enough resources, mixing two different societies or two different cultures together very suddenly can cause a lot of conflict and friction between the groups. And so if she wants to successfully be the leader of all of these people, she needs to come up with ways to navigate those differences. And yeah, I think it's just super realistic.
Yeah.
You know, immigration and migration are hot topics all of the time, all around the world. And you always see those two different kind of opposing views of it, which I'm sure is where you came up with this is, you know, current events.
Yeah, there's a lot to be said about immigration in general and this, and like a lot of what you're about to see is just sort of my commentary and thoughts and maybe some angles that nobody's really approached or thought about before.
Yeah, because I end up coming up with some pretty good solutions
later
on down the line. And it's a good mix of the two ideas and then some new ideas are thought of to how to deal with this off-gridder situation. But first they're interrupted by our old friends, Lord Chiefs Len and Norsen, who are still kind of living like they were under Vibran, and they're not being very good leaders.
No. Jerem even says that she should have killed them. And, you know, in our notes we have in quotations, uh-oh, is she becoming more like Vibran? Like, just in essence that is a little bit of a cold and callous thought, but these guys aren't really doing much to improve anything, and they're very self-centered, so it's tough to have to work with people like that.
Yeah, I think it was half joking, half not, but even Shindo is like, well, we can't kill them because we have no one to replace them, so we have to deal with them.
Yep.
But they make the Norsen and Len wait half a day before they agree to see them, so it's kind of this political power play. And Jerem specifically agrees to see them in the what was once called the Ascendancy Chamber, but is now called the Inner Sanctum. And it's that room with the electrical cage in it that Shindo had built, and then those murals on the walls. So I like how she keeps using this as a power play.
Yeah.
But the reason that Len and Norsen are there is because they said the Lord Chief reward system is broken because Tersona has won 3 times in a row. And they're being sore losers because they do not deserve to win. Shindo says that they need to show more improvement, but they try to make this argument that Cade was damaged less in the wars previously, so therefore Tersona has an advantage over the improvements. But when they really start to dig into it, we see that they are misappropriating funds, and I love how Shindo just calls them out on this. Because it's such an abuse of power, and
right, it's like the classic case of corruption within like a political structure.
Yeah, so he specifically points out, like, "Hey, Lord Chief Len, you bought new cars, you expanded your house, you filled up your cellar with kegs, you got new tattoos, and you've been paying your own lieutenants instead of using the money on the settlement." And then they call out Norsen, too, because he's constantly buying jewelry and changing his haircut all the time and also spending his money on things that you should not be spending it on, because that money is supposed to go towards improving their cities.
Yeah, and these Lord Chiefs are mad. They don't react to the criticisms well at all. They accuse Shindo and Jerem of sleeping together and plotting to overthrow them. So, again, they're just being sore losers. And so Jerem activates the cage and threatens that she is the commander-in-chief and she does not have to listen to them, that they have to answer their complaints right in front of them, aka stop spending all the money on yourselves.
Thankfully, they just sort of are cowed by this and agree, like, fine, we won't keep spending all our money on ourselves. They've been caught, which I think was good because, again, another kind of commentary just on, like, power and politics. Like, people at the top, even like CEOs and stuff, not even necessarily people involved directly in politics, but like they're the kind of people who have, you know, multi-million dollar salaries when their employees can't afford food. So the balance is all messed up. And then when you call them out on it, you know, they get all sour about it and refuse to cut any of their pay. And they say they earned that money. And here we have it where it actually, they get called out and
they toe the line, so to speak.
Yeah. The message goes through, so we'll see if they actually end up doing that later on and spending the money on their people instead of themselves, but I wish that the equal distribution of wealth was as easily solved in our world as it just was in this scene, because it's bad.
Bring them to the electric cage.
The other little agreement, though, to make them do this is that Shindo asks if they will help him, and then in exchange, they will, instead of giving the reward to Tersona, alternate it between Lan and Norsen. But before they can agree to this, Jerem cuts him off. And she's like, what are you making this agreement for? Why did you come up with this plan on the fly instead of talking to me about it? But Shindo said he had had an idea that could expand the domain and would solve their problem with the off-gridders, because they would be able to take on more people in exchange for giving less money to Lan and Norsen. He's, again, trying to think of the common good and what would be best for the most amount of people. So Shindo really is an altruistic and emotionally driven leader. To get this idea through to Jerem, he says he wants to go see the off-gridders, and he wants Jerem to come with him because he thinks that he'll be able to change her mind about the situation once she sees it firsthand.
There's a lot on the line here, and it could be a very risky gamble for Shindo.
I think it's going to play off. I think it'll work out.
He knows what he's doing, but at the same time, it just is a lot of factors.
So we get a small time jump into the next year. It's December, so we're approaching the worst part of winter, and we're back with Kellen and Mattis. And they, like we saw with so many other people who are starting to gather at Canyon and Hood, they have driven their all-terrain, they've abandoned their off-grid, and are coming to the domain to try to get in. One thing, just like a side note about the all-terrain, is that it can drive on land and water, which I think is pretty cool. So I'm hoping that Shindo will be able to use that idea or that technology to make more all-terrains, because theirs is on its last leg, I would say.
Yeah.
They're working on repairing it in this scene.
And as they're working on the all-terrain, they're blocked by a canyon, so they're in a bit of a tough position. They've made a little tent along its edge, and they've been there for about a month, and the domain has been providing food, but not much else. Kellen and Mattis, they get into an argument because Mattis can't find the wrench. Mattis brings up how Kellen also made a mistake by not leaving the off-grid for the domain sooner. So it's just everyone's tempers are rising and their frustration is at the forefront.
Yeah, even Mattis kind of throws the situation back in Kellen's face because Kellen says something about like learning a lesson about not leaving tools around. And Mattis says, what kind of lesson? Like the one you learned when you refused to leave the off-grid? At least this lesson didn't have the cost of that one. And we learn that their off-grid actually had a fire and 20 people died. And that was finally the straw that broke the camel's back. That was the push for them to go to the domain.
Yeah.
So I'm sure that they're just one of many, many sob stories in terms of how tough these people have had it in order to up and leave their homes and go to the domain.
You know, tensions have been rising at the camp between Kellen, Mattis, Zach, and Celia. Celia even tries to persuade Kellen to go over the mountains, that they should leave the all-terrains behind and only carry what they need. She says that we're getting nowhere staying here and that it's not getting better. We've survived this much. You're telling me one short trip across will be the end of us. And, you know, she's cool. She's a fighter. But again, there's always that fear of the unknown where you don't know what you're going to run into up there. So it's, again, a big risk to just assume it's going to be fine and to go for it.
I think it's one of those things, though, when your back's against the wall and you don't have anything else you can turn to. They've already left their home. They're running out of time. They're running out of supplies. Their all terrain is broken. How long will you hold out to do something about it? And I like that it's different for all the characters. Like Celia's trying to come up with a solution. Kellen is saying he's becoming less stubborn, but he's still going to think about it. Especially because he's not sure what this, you know, this commander chief, Jerem, what's she all about? And then we have Zach, who's doing a different approach, which is talking to the soldiers. And he's getting hopeful that they'll let them into the domain if they get a chance to talk to them enough. So different approaches to the situation. Eventually it's going to work out, but we're going to kind of see whose position works best.
Yeah. Nate, I guess our question for you is, obviously, this is your world, your characters, so you have a third eye to see beyond the choices of these characters. But if you were in this type of situation yourself with so much being unknown, what do you think you would do if you were in a situation like this?
So if I was an off-gridder?
Yeah.
Basically, I think what you're asking me is, essentially, what would I do if I, like, was a migrant and I had to immigrate somewhere better and the place I was in wasn't that safe and not really profitable and I had to take a risk. There would just be so much that was unknown. I think I want to say I would make the best of a bad situation. I mean, there's often times situations like these, yeah, sort of sit with a campfire by other migrants and you just swap stories and then you try to keep each other happy. Maybe somebody's got a guitar and they can sing something or they just sing songs in general. But I can see a lot of people, if they're in a bad enough situation like this, they might just not want to go on. It might just be like, what's the point if I'm just going to suffer and not be happy? Unfortunately. Yeah, I could just say as I would make the best of a bad situation. But at the same time, I don't think a lot of us know exactly what we'd do unless we were in the situation. Mm. And as an example, this is a bit of an aside, but I remember when I first worked at a video game company, people would ask me, how long would it be before you asked for help? And I think I said, like, it would be when I was absolutely needed it. And then the reality was I kept asking people all the time because I didn't immediately know what to do with something instead of just trying to figure it out. So again, it's like, this is what you think is going to happen. And this is what actually happens.
Mm.
So, yeah.
That's the best answer I can give at the moment.
No, that's totally cool.
I feel like I'm not much of a risk taker. So even though I really like Celia's character, I would not be inclined to try to climb the mountains and abandon my belongings. Just because that seems like walking into the unknown, even though her argument is they already did that and they're still here. I think I would probably be most like Zach, where he's trying to, he's still pretty hopeful. He's more social than Kellen, and he's definitely interested in learning about the domain and by talking to other people here, other off-gridders and the soldiers. And I think he wants people to feel sorry for them, whereas Kellen is very proud. And I think that that can be tough in a situation like this. So I think I would probably have an approach most similar to Zach.
Mm. Yeah, I could see that. And I agree to a certain extent. It's tough. You know, like, again, nothing's guaranteed. There's so much unknown. So it's hard to say what you would do unless you're in that situation. I just found that this scene provided a good mental exercise and to put yourself in different characters' shoes and, you know, ask yourself, what would you think you would do?
I would like to think that I'm the adventurous type and would, you know, give up on this plan and go over the mountains and start fresh somewhere else. But I know that I'm not that way.
Yeah. This is like, as an aside, like the Hogwarts sorting house is all over again, where for years I assumed, you know, I'm bold and adventurous, that I love to play the hero, that I'd be like a Gryffindor. And then in like reality, like, no, I'm just a chill Hufflepuff. I'm just hanging out, just like my friends, doing my thing. So, yeah, definitely just expectations versus reality kind of thing.
Yeah, definitely. It seems like Zach's kind of approach is working best for them, I suppose. Or, like, that's what ends up coming to fruition in this next scene. Because Zach says there's soldiers coming around to talk to people. And Zach is really hopeful that they'll let them into the domain if they get a chance to tell their story. Whereas Kellen says he will be fairly tight-lipped. So Zach actually gets mad and leaves so that when the soldiers come, they only have Kellen to talk to. And I think we find out later is that Zach got a chance to talk to the soldiers on his own, because a couple of days after this, some soldiers come to collect Kellen and bring him to Jerem. And he gets to go into the city, which is pretty cool. It's like built up over the canyon, like you said. So he's really intrigued by it. And he does say that, like, getting to go in it is a big step forward for their situation. And surprisingly, he gets to go right to Jerem and Shindo, and then Zach is there, and Zach has been talking to them. So Zach sweet-talked his way into getting to tell their story. And we get a little side moment where Kellen immediately thinks that Zach is in trouble and says he'll take all the responsibility for him. So even though Kellen's a bit gruff and stubborn on the outside, he really has his family's interests at heart and, like, would do anything for them. So I like his sort of gruff exterior but soft interior as a character, and how you were able to show that through just this, like, quick little interaction or thought he had.
I love that the little side notes that we have in this where we wrote for Kellen in the scene, he does care. It's just fun. During the scene, Jerem and Shindo ask Kellen to tell them everything. And this is where Kellen recognizes Shindo as odd, but thinks he couldn't lie to save his life, but an honest man couldn't be a bad one. So Kellen loses his wariness of the domain. So some trust is beginning to be established here, where Jerem and Shindo spend several days listening to the people's stories at both Hood and Canyon. And Shindo says it's their responsibility to help.
Yeah, so obviously they're talking to other people other than Kellen and his family. And he's just building up sympathy for them. I think it's actually really an effective way to show Jerem what they need to be doing. It's hard to be calculated when you're thinking of people in terms of, like, a problem or just numbers, which is what Jerem had been doing. And Shindo's thinking of them as people who can be helpful and people who deserve help as well. They come up with several plans here, which I'm pretty excited because they're definitely going to get a chance to move forward with some of these during the book. So Shindo's looking at maps that the off-gridders have drawn to show where they came from in the interior, and there's all these different sources for scrap metal, which is good because they're getting low where they are, and they've been having to pull them out of concrete at the ruins, which is a really difficult procedure. So I'm assuming they're trying to get, like, rebar out of reinforced concrete, which is tough. Side note, mid-conversation, Shindo has a weird reaction to the crown. He, like, his head falls back and he loses his balance. So he has been wearing it this whole time. And I think eventually that's going to start to be more and more dangerous. I'm a little nervous about him.
Yeah, 10 years and heavy is the crown, you know? it definitely has its side effects starting to emerge.
Right. So we'll see how long he can hold out against it. For now, it gives him a good idea. He invents this whole machine that's going to be able to drive itself and self-direct and then can scan all these areas to see how much scrap metal is buried there and what metals they are.
So maybe like a ground penetrating radar or something.
Yeah, some kind of ground penetrating radar combined with metal detector.
Yeah.
Is what I'm picturing. But I love that they're going to be able to self-erect themselves so that they don't have to go out there into Rust Razor territory and build them themselves. Like, they can just deploy.
Yeah.
It almost reminds me of, like, the Mars rovers a little bit. Something like that. Yeah, so now that he has had this idea, Shindo really hopes to get a bunch of these deployed by spring. But obviously, Jerem is worried because the territory, now that there's no off-gridders there, is completely controlled by Rust Razors. And she compromises and says they can go to half of the off-grids, the ones that still have some defenses, but that they'll need to double the size of their military to set up all of these mining posts eventually where they're going to be getting the scrap metal. And this is where we start to get these good ideas where Shindo's like, well, we have all these people, all these off-gridders have showed up, and they're looking to come into our society and be a part of the domain. We need soldiers, medics. We're going to need people to mine the scrap metal. It sounds like this could be a win-win for everybody if that's how we can funnel the population towards this problem that will help benefit everyone.
Mm-hmm.
And Shindo gets pretty excited with this idea. He says he really wants to push outward and send the Rust Razors a message. You know, we saw them way back under Vibran. They're pretty ruthless mercenaries. So, again, just sort of like remnants of that old society. He wants to show them that they're not going to stand for that anymore.
I know, but it's like totally poking the bear.
I know.
And so, you know, they're like, we'll put a base here. It'll be great. We'll show them. And it's like, this spells trouble. I just have that sinking gut feeling. Like,
oh, the last scene at the end of this chapter, which we'll talk about in a minute. Like, we know that this is about to cause conflict.
Yeah.
So, yeah, Jerem says they should build a base right in the middle of Rust Razor territory to show them who's boss.
They're going to get decimated.
It's a bold plan for sure. I think it shows how bold and almost like more military oriented Jerem has become. But it does take this idea of the off-gridders being a problem and turning the whole situation into a solution, which I think is really good in terms of how Shindo is playing off Jerem's ideas as leaders, and they work really well together.
Yeah, it's definitely altruistic.
And even the very last line of this section, they're having this conversation late at night, and then the section ends with this paragraph that says, "Everything would have to start tomorrow. Strategies of this scale weren't Shindo's strong point, but his insights left Jerem wondering why she hadn't thought of them herself. Sometimes she forgot that they leaned on each other's strengths. Her last thought, before turning in, was hoping it would never stop." And I love that their bond as leaders works so well. Can you talk a little bit about the process you had of like building their leadership styles and their bonds through these differences? Because I think you could have had a lot more conflict between them because they have different ideas, but you've turned it into a really positive and progressive dynamic between the two of them.
Yeah, so I wouldn't say there's not conflict. I mean, you argue and sometimes not see eye to eye, but at the end of the day, they are friends and they don't hate each other. And in terms of styles, so originally, in like early revisions, it was Shindo who was supposed to be the leader, and then Jerem that was supposed to be like the head of the military. But the way I kept writing it was she kept having more and more of a prominent role. So I just said, why don't I just make them dual heads of state? So how I create this contrast is Jerem, because she comes from that underground archive, basically has a detailed history of what happens in societies when they make certain decisions and why they have to make that. And then Shindo has this ideal of why can't we just do this? Because there's a lot about, I guess you can say, running a society and societies in general. He doesn't know. But then occasionally when Jerem shows him something or teaches him something, he has a different take on it and he'll like think of it in a different way and say, well, why can't we do this? And then when she thinks about it, she's like, well, hey, wait a minute, that kind of works. So that's ultimately what I came to. So yeah, she's a, here's what's realistic. And then Shindo's like, let's do this, or let's really try to get to this. So that's where some of their arguing, friendly arguing comes in, but ultimately how they eventually come to a consensus.
No, I think it works well because I think Jerem does kind of represent the established ideas and tactics that have worked in the past and kind of looking at problems from the same perspective. And Shindo really shakes that up and says, well, why can't we? Like, there's nothing stopping us from having these solutions. Like, we don't need to look at the off-gridders here as a problem. We can look at them as a potential. And he has done it so many times. So I really like the dynamic, and I think it pushes their society to be different from a lot of the other societies and even societies we see in our own world. So I'm really enjoying how they work well together as leaders.
Yeah, they're definitely fighting the good fight.
Ugh, they're about to be fighting a fight with Engine, though, because we just get a scene shift at the end of this, which leaves us with a sense of danger at the end of this chapter. So we haven't seen Engine, I think, since chapter 1 or 2 during the conversation that he was having when Vibran was having his big post-ceremony dinner.
Yeah. So his attack dog has been waiting and his teeth are bared. He is he is ready for some violence. And Engine's second-in-command, Torque, tells him how much the Domain has spread. Engine makes a plan to tell the Domain that they'll resume trade in exchange for leaving the off-gridders alone.
Yeah, there was like some references to how Jerem and Shindo hadn't dealt with the Rustrazers before. And so there's like leftover unresolved like relations between the Rustrazers and the Domain. Engine makes his plan, but he wants the plan to fail, like the offer that he makes to fail, so that they can use it as an excuse to attack the Domain. And then he gets his revenge, and then he can also get his hands on all of the cool stuff that Shindo has created over the past 10 years. So Engine is definitely still of the mindset of like pillage and steal.
Yeah.
Which is so different from the direction the Domain has been going in. So this is tough.
Yeah, even Torque is nervous of the fight, but Engine says, did you forget we're Rustrazers and that we own death? That's why we do things that are too afraid to do. We push ourselves through the pain because we choose not to feel it. We're outnumbered, but they don't take risks like we do. And so there is truly always something extraordinarily dangerous with like nothing to lose, everything to gain type of mindset. And because they are so willing to do anything, whatever dirty tactic that may be, when you forego your morals and you're just in it to win, it truly creates a very dangerous enemy.
Mm-hmm.
It's about to get heavy. Things are about to go down, and I'm worried for our characters.
On top of it, Engine also says they have the advantage of the territory because they own this dam that controls a lot of the waterways, but it's also like their territory, and he thinks they should start this by setting up a trap where they capture some hostages, as well as making an alliance with the remaining off-gridders that didn't move. So he's going to pit them against the other gang crews and the Domain. So he's got a lot of plans up his sleeve. Is this going to be the first, I guess, fighting conflict that the Domain has had, like an external conflict since Jerem and Shindo took over?
Yes.
Ooh, okay. So we're going to get to see a lot of how they've been preparing come out to play, I guess.
Yeah.
I'm interested to see if Shindo has to return to making war machines, because that's something he doesn't want to have to do again, but it might be sort of the necessity of the moment. And I like that you've got these two very different types of societies. One is like a sort of centralized, established civilization that's the Domain. And, you know, they've got sort of central governing, whereas the Rustrazers are more of like a nomadic style, and Engine's their leader, but there's lots of other gang crews out there that aren't really under his control. So there's sort of like different societal developments happening at this point too.
Yeah.
And we're going to see which one prevails.
And just as like a sidebar, I love the stylization with even just like the name, like the Rustrazers, the character's name of Torque and Engine. You just get that like heavy metal post-apocalyptic like vibe. And I just really appreciate how even something so simple as that, you can just envision such a sense of like what these characters look like, how they're dressed, you know. It's just,
you know, they're gonna fight dirty.
Yeah
they're gonna be tough enemies for sure.
Oh yeah. And it's just I just appreciate it. It's cool.
Yeah, I think they're a really good villain. Vibran was the first villain, and then this is sort of like fallout from his society coming back in the form of these gangs. Yeah. So I like that they're a little bit different. The fight's going to be a different fight. It's not going to be on the domain's territory, so I don't know how it's going to go, honestly.
I think it's going to go very poorly. I think not for the Rust Raisers. I think it's going to be tough for our heroes here. Now that we mentioned, you know, like the foreshadowing of like, we'll do whatever it takes, and they talk about hostages and the dam, I could very well envision like them pulling a huge military force out to meet them, and then like potentially like a dam opening up and washing them all away. Like, I don't know. I have a feeling like it's not just going to be like a skirmish. Like, I think whatever transpires next is going to be like the stakes are going to be high. Yeah.
Ooh. I think you're probably onto that, because Engine definitely has this sort of tactic, like you said, of I'll do anything.
Mm.
But I'm interested to see. I think Jera might be tempted to stoop to the same tactics of like, well, if they took hostages, we'll take hostages. That's just because that's sort of established practices. And I think, again, Shindo's going to have to really say, like, that's not what we're about.
Yeah.
Why don't we do things in a different way? And he's going to come up with the creative ways to win the fight.
Day. Yeah. Mm-hmm.
That's my prediction.
That's a good one. We'll have to wait and see.
I don't know even if that's going to be like the final conflict of the book too, because the plot has taken so many twists and turns.
I know. It's really been such an evolution. So
we'll have to find out next week, because there's 2 episodes left after this one.
Wow.
So a lot can happen in that. A lot can happen.
Oh, you'll see.
I know we're going to get the scene you said I'm excited about. So that's one tiny little tidbit of a guess of what could happen. But
yep. Send the Amazon warriors in. They'll take care of it.
I don't know. You've been very unpredictable with, like, your plots haven't followed any kind of standard 3-act or like assumption of like, oh, the good guys are always going to win. You know, you keep us on our toes a lot with this. So
yeah, I've really appreciated that. I'm excited to
see actually how it all plays out. Any final predictions or thoughts? Do you think anyone's going to die in the fight with the Rust Raisers?
Oh, absolutely.
Like in our main characters.
I don't think so yet. I think there's going to be like provocation, retaliation, and then like if there's another battle, then we might lose some, like, premier homies.
Ooh, okay.
And I hope not. I like all of our characters, but too. Yeah, that's where I'm at.
All right, we'll have to find out. Thanks, listeners. If you're looking for more, check us out at fantasticbookspod.com, where we have book reviews, reading list suggestions, merch, and you can even send us a message.
Or find us on Facebook and Instagram at fantasticbookspod.
And if you like what you've been hearing, don't forget to leave us a review.
Thanks.
Golden Rise Media.